This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Amy Bloom, has written a new memoir that begins with going with her husband to Zurich to end his life. Why Zurich? Because even the few states with right-to-life laws in the U.S. have such stringent requirements, he didn't qualify. He'd decided, after being diagnosed with Alzheimer's in his mid-60s, that he wanted to end his life while he was still himself. Although by the time he actually did it, his Alzheimer's had progressed to the point where he'd lost a lot of memory and cognition. Bloom and her husband Brian Amici were middle-aged and in other relationships when they fell in love and then married in 2007. Amici had been an architect and played football for Yale. Amici succeeded in terminating his life in late January 2020, just weeks before COVID shut everything down. Amy Bloom is a novelist and short story writer who has been a National Book Award finalist, a National Book Critics Circle Award nominee, and a recipient of a National Magazine Award. She's the Shapiro Silverberg Professor of Creative Writing at Wesleyan University. Her new memoir, called In Love, is centered around her husband's diagnosis and her quest to help him end his life in the manner he chose. The book also keeps flashing back to their life together and how it was changed by Alzheimer's. Amy Bloom, welcome to Fresh Air. This is a very moving book, beautifully written. I really love it. Thank you very much for coming.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I hope you're well.
I am. It's a complicated time, but I do feel okay.
I am glad to hear that. I want to start with a reading that I think will answer a lot of listeners' questions. And it's about the loop that was in your mind about helping your husband end his life.
Yes. I worry sometimes that a better wife, certainly a different wife, would have said no, would have insisted on keeping her husband in this world until his body gave out. It seems to me that I'm doing the right thing in supporting Brian in his decision, but it would feel better and easier if he could make all the arrangements himself and I could just be a dutiful duckling following in his wake. Of course, if he could make all the arrangements himself, he wouldn't have Alzheimer's. And if he had wanted to make all the arrangements on his own, he wouldn't have been Brian.
When did your husband tell you that he wanted to die? How soon was it after getting the diagnosis of Alzheimer's?
I would say it was probably within 3 days of getting the diagnosis. Partially, I think, because this is an issue that he had thought about himself earlier in his life. He had strong feelings about people's rights to agency and autonomy. It was part of why he was such a strong supporter of Planned Parenthood his entire life as an activist. And also, he, I think, knew himself and knew his own personality and his own style and his own needs.
What was your initial response when he told you he wanted to terminate his life? What was your initial response to say, I love you, please don't?
I didn't say, I love you, please don't, but I did say, we can do this. I will take care of you. I love you. I will protect you. I will be there for you every inch of the way in this process. The gist of which was, I love you, please don't. And he said, I don't want to argue about this. This is what I need to do. And I know I need to do this, and this is what I want to do. I don't want to leave, he said. But since I'm going to leave you either way, I want to do it this way.
Did you think that maybe he wanted to end his life to protect you from the responsibility and the emotional trauma and the expense that would be involved if he continued to live?
I'm sure that that was part of his consideration. But I will also say that Brian was somebody who once said to me, in the pyramid of life, I put myself at the top.
Over you.
He did say that. He was pretty forthright.
So what stage of Alzheimer's was he in when he was diagnosed? You knew something was wrong by then.
I had certainly noticed things being wrong for the last few years, and I am so sympathetic with all the other people who talk about being sort of blindsided by the diagnosis. I don't feel that I was blindsided, but I understood that something was changing very dramatically, sort of dramatically and subtly. And in some sense, I think if you are not intimate with your with the person who has Alzheimer's, it might be a little harder to see, especially if they are smart, educated, or high IQ people, educated or not, because they have learned so many appropriate responses, and it tends to hide the crumbling structure beneath.
He said he wanted to end his life while he was still himself.
Yes.
Did you think of him as still himself, or did you see enough decline that you felt like, this isn't really the man I married?
I felt both. I mean, there were many ways in which he was very much the man I married. At one point, I described his guiding principles of his life as take yes for an answer, better to ask forgiveness than permission, and if there's going to be a fight, throw the first punch. And I think all of those things really came together for him, and those things were always present in him until the very end. But other things that were sort of, in some sense, more superficial, you know, short-term memory. By the time we went to Zurich, he could not recall the names of the grandchildren, all of whom he adored and who adored him. But also, you know, he would get lost in the supermarket. And, of course, we stopped going separately, but I remember the last time he was in the grocery store, which is 5 minutes from our house, and which he had gone to 1,000 times, he just couldn't maneuver his way around it. So in those things, it was really clear that the disease was taking its toll. In other ways, in terms of his nature as a determined and largely fearless person, it had not taken that from him.
Let's talk about why going to Zurich was your only option. There are states where it's legal to terminate your life under certain circumstances. Why didn't he not qualify in any of those states?
Nobody with dementia would qualify in any of those states because it is a terminal disease diagnosis is required, and terminal means that you will be dead within the next 6 months, period. It doesn't mean you have a terminal disease. You might be dead in a couple of years. You might be dead in a year and a half. 6 months, you have to find a doctor who will say that you will be dead in 6 months. There are not that many doctors who are prepared to say this is an absolute fact. And you have to be able to take the medication, the lethal dosage, yourself, which for somebody with Alzheimer's might or might not be a problem, but for somebody with some other kind of disease like ALS would be a genuine obstacle to overcome.
And do you have to prove that you're psychologically in your right mind and knowing what you're doing?
Well, yes, you certainly have to be able to display sort of judgment and cognitive functioning and discernment, which I support entirely. But it is the combination of the timing, the terminal diagnosis, and the cognitive function that makes this such a thread the eye of a needle process for so many people.
And there's no option of saying, I know what I'm doing now. Next year or in 2 years, I probably won't know what I'm doing. So I'm telling you now that when that time comes, here's how I want to end my life.
That is not a thing in the United States.
During the time you were traveling to Zurich and while you were there waiting for the final end to begin, did you talk a lot about death? Did you talk a lot about your relationship? Were there long, tearful goodbyes, or did you just try to live moment by moment?
I think most of the tears were on my part. So for me, the whole trip was a long, tearful goodbye. I think for him, he had made up his mind. He knew what he was going to do. He was focused on what he needed to do, and his own process about that, his own process of departure. We held hands a lot, and we took a lot of naps, and we walked around the city together. We didn't talk much about what was coming, and we didn't talk a lot about our life together and how it had brought us to this and what would be next. He did say, you know, I hate to leave so soon. He also said, I am not afraid.
The doctors kept telling him he could change his mind anytime and that would be fine. They'd be happy for him if he decided to live, and that a lot of people do change their mind after actually getting there. And they asked him that like many times. Was it reassuring for you that they were giving him an honorable out, but he was certain of what he wanted to do?
It was reassuring to me. I think it was also, I think that was something that met with Brian's approval. He thought it was the right thing for them to ask repeatedly. He actually said that at one point. He said, I appreciate your asking. I will be giving you the same answer every time. I don't know that there are a lot of people who change their mind once they are in Zurich, although I'm sure that there are some. And of course, there are many people who apply to the organization as sort of an insurance policy and never follow through.
So the procedure for his death involved taking a drug that prevents nausea, and then waiting a while, and then taking the poison, in this case, the drug was sodium pentobarbital, which might ring a bell because it's a drug that's been used in America for executions of people on death row. During that period, when you were waiting for the end, after he took the anti-nausea medication, who did you feel you had to be for him at that point? What did you want him to read on your face? Or did you have no control over that?
Well, I am cursed with a pretty expressive face, which so far I have been unable to overcome. But I knew what he saw on my face because I knew what I felt, and what he saw was love. And we held hands and we kissed, and he fell into a light sleep and then a deeper sleep. It was a very, very peaceful process.
Did you want to make sure he wasn't seeing fear in your face?
I did not want him to see fear in my face. I also didn't feel fear at that moment. I knew that this is what he wanted, and he was at peace with it, and he was glad to be able to accomplish what he had wanted to accomplish. Not happy, but glad and relieved. And I think what he saw on my face was that I was there for him.
At the end, some of the things he was talking about had to do with memories of when he was playing football at Yale. And, you didn't even know him then. It was like decades before you knew him. Did you feel excluded? I'm sorry to ask that, but I just kind of felt for you when I was reading that.
Well, you know, as one does in marriage, sometimes one feels more than one thing. I felt very much that these were such happy memories for him. It was such a wonderful period in his life. Without any internal conflict, he loved playing football. He was good at football. He had loved his coach. It was a time in his life when he had a lot of support from his dad. All of those things. And so I was happy to see him in some sense sort of, running in that meadow again, which is very much how it felt. I would have liked, not at that moment, because for me at that moment, that was what he needed and that was what gave him joy and comfort. And I was very glad for that. I feel like, there might have been opportunities for more conversations about our life together, maybe earlier in the 4 days in Zurich. But I also felt that in some way that was fairly selfish of me. You know, there he was, about to step off into this extraordinary act of self-determination. Probably wasn't the time that I needed to focus on. What about me? So I did my best not to.
When you were talking to him during his cognitive decline, did you change your tone of voice?
I'm sure I did. And I made a real effort to unchange my tone of voice, because at one point he said to me, "You're talking to me like I'm a patient," because prior to being a novelist, I had been a clinical social worker for many years. And I'm not sure that that was the case, but since that's what he experienced, I made a real effort not to speak to him that way. But it was often a case of conflicting needs, which is that I needed, not just for myself, but for whatever was going on in our life at that time, to be clear and to make sure that he understood and that we were on the same page and we were going to go approach this the same way. And, you know, that kind of emphatic and also, I hope, empathetic approach can be helpful. But there are also times when he didn't care for, as I would say, he didn't care for my tone.
Do you think your experiences of having been a clinical social worker earlier in your life were helpful?
I don't think it hurt. I think that being trained to listen, being trained not to finish somebody's sentence for them, being trained to try to hear what the person wished to express and not argue with them about their narrative, but to understand their narrative was useful to me, for sure.
Did you have, like, a community of people, a network of people who helped you when your husband was in decline? And how much did you want to tell them? How much, especially early on, how much did you want to acknowledge to other people what was going on?
Well, I didn't want to acknowledge it, and I didn't want to tell people about it. I think my complaints, I'm sure, to my friends, must have sounded much more like middle-aged wife complaints. Ah, he's so stubborn. He's not doing this. He's not doing that. He sits in front of the TV. And so I certainly did make those kinds of complaints. But I think I am very, very lucky in having a circle of very close, very supportive friends, people who loved him, people who loved me, and the inner circle of my family. I was really, truly fortunate to have the support and love of the people around me.
Did your husband advise you what he wanted to do with his body after death, since he was arranging his own death?
Yes, he did. He had quite a few thoughts about it and directives. And he picked out the poetry for his memorial service. He picked out the music for his memorial service. It was probably just an oversight that he didn't pick out the food for his memorial service. And although I think he had a lot of ideas about where he wanted his body to be buried, in the end, he had a couple of very strong preferences, and that is what we did.
What was the music he wanted played?
Bill Evans. Big Bill Evans fan, as I am, as he was.
I'm very grateful to you, and I wish you good health and all good things.
Thank you so much, and the same to you, Terry. I really appreciate this.
Amy Bloom is the author of the new book, In Love, A Memoir of Love and Loss. If you're a fan of New Yorker cartoons, you've probably seen and enjoyed the work of my guest, David Cypress. Since 1998, he's been a staff cartoonist at the magazine, where he's published about 700 cartoons. In 2012, during the presidential campaign, he became the magazine's first daily cartoonist on the New Yorker website. He did daily cartoons again in 2014 and twice in 2016 during the presidential primary and the campaign. His new memoir, What's So Funny, is about his life and about cartooning. The book is illustrated with his cartoons. David Cypress, welcome to Fresh Air. I love your cartoons. Thank you for being here. Let's start with your most published and tweeted cartoon. Would you describe it?
Yeah, it's two people walking down the street, a woman and a man. And the woman is turning to them, well, she's sort of looking up at the sky and saying, "My desire to be well-informed is currently at odds with my desire to remain sane."
That has been true for so many years right now. When did you write it?
I wrote that sometime during the 90s. It's not a New Yorker cartoon. I never can remember where it first started, but I think it was during the whole Bosnia problem. And it was so upsetting getting up every day and reading the paper, something we're familiar with right now. And every time the world goes, you know, down the toilet, that cartoon begins to show up all over the internet. I think what's interesting about that cartoon is it's not actually funny, you know, it's not a joke. It's something I've learned to do about these difficult things that happen in the world, how to make a cartoon about them. And I try not to hit them over the head or go straight for them. I try to think about what I'm feeling about what's going on and make a cartoon like that one, which is, it was exactly how I feel right now about everything going on. And after 50 years of doing this, I've discovered that my feelings match the feelings of my audience a lot of the time. And it's that moment of recognition that creates the humor rather than an out-and-out joke.
As we record this, there's a 40-mile convoy of Russian tanks heading toward Kyiv. So on days like this, do you think about cartooning, or do you feel like this is not the time for cartoons, or at least topical cartoons? It's hard to find anything funny about what's going on now.
It's not the kind of thing that sends me to my studio to think up cartoons. It's just so dangerous to attempt to make a joke out of a terrible situation like this. Maybe in a week, maybe in 2 weeks, maybe when things calm down, I'll be able to go back to this strategy I have of trying to make a cartoon about what our response is to the events, not a joke about the events themselves. But right now, I really feel like I need to back off of that and think about things like a cartoon about what I had for dinner, or how I don't have enough money in the bank.
You spent a lot of time doing daily cartoons for the New Yorker's website. You did it in 2012 during the presidential election. You did it again in 2014 and twice in 2016. You did it for the presidential primaries and the presidential election. How did you see Trump and the primaries and the election differently having to do daily cartoons than you might have if you weren't doing that?
Well, the first thing is that the kind of avoidance I was talking about a moment ago was not possible. I was forced every single day to open the newspaper and try to come up with something, and to come up with something fast, because by 8 o'clock I had to send in my idea. And it became more and more difficult during the Trump years, precisely because Trump sort of trumped cartoons and trumped jokes, at least for me. Cartoons depend a lot on exaggeration, and all the exaggeration started to come true with Trump, at least for me. So I found it harder and harder to make cartoons about him, and I turned my attention to other aspects of the news eventually. And I also think the audience was getting pretty tired of Trump jokes. So during that latter part of my stint as daily cartoonist, I tried more and more to avoid him, or if I did depict him, I started depicting him not as Donald Trump, but I would create sort of a medieval setting and use him in the position of a king. For example, there's one cartoon I did of the king saying to one of his advisors, "I don't know much about science, but I know what I like."
That is funny.
And that was a way of saying something about Trump without depicting him or going at it directly.
I want to get back to Ukraine for a moment. Your father immigrated from Ukraine when he was a child with his parents. He was born in 1905. Did he talk much about what he left behind in Ukraine and what it was like to, you know, be on the ship coming to America and land here?
Well, a lot of the theme of my memoir is about secrecy and spending a life trying to get my father to tell me anything about that distant past. I don't think it's unusual for immigrants of my father's generation to have that sort of urge to forget about all that and not talk about it. My father was kind of an extreme example. I just could never get any of my questions answered, and anything I figured out about it, I figured out on my own by overhearing conversations, doing snooping around the apartment into records, and even just going to the library and reading about what was going on. But there was very little about my father's immigrant past that he ever talked about, except to say things about how terrible crossing with all the hoi polloi, as he put it, and steerage was. And then finally, if I can say another cartoon, what I ended up with was I expressed in a cartoon I did a few years ago of a father and a kid standing in Brooklyn, sort of looking towards Manhattan. And the father is saying, "The country I came from was a stinking hellhole of unspeakable poverty where everyone was always happy." And that was sort of the mixed message that I got through all the secrecy. But that's about as far as I got with information until just before my father died.
I want to mention another cartoon that you've done that kind of combines your work as a cartoonist for The New Yorker and your life as a patient in therapy. Can you describe that cartoon?
I think the caption is, it's the patient lying on the couch with a therapist, and sitting in the corner is a woman with a notepad, and the therapist is saying, "That's Eleanor. She'll be fact-checking your therapy session."
And, you know, The New Yorker is famous for its fact-checking. Do you worry that the things you tell your therapist might not quite be accurate?
Well, you know, it's such an interesting question, because really where that whole thing came up was about writing this book and about memory. And in fact, one of the things that I learned in therapy was that in a way it doesn't really matter whether the facts check out, because the stories that you tell yourself about the past have their own truth, the truth about you. And that was really helpful to me in writing my memoir, because I don't have many sort of first-person sources. I only have what I remember. And if I stop myself every page to think, well, if a fact checker looked at this, they'd know that such and such didn't happen, I would never have finished the book. So at some point, I sort of let go of the need to fact check and just wrote my stories. And I think I can say that they have a truth that is absolutely genuine as far as I'm concerned.
You tried for years to get published in The New Yorker. What was that process like of constantly submitting cartoons and constantly getting rejected?
Well, yeah, it took me 25 years of submitting. People often say, well, why didn't you give up? It must have been dispiriting. How did you keep going? And I did keep going precisely because if you do what I do, which is make single panel cartoons, there really is The New Yorker and then everything else. And so since my dream from the time I was about 6 years old was to be a New Yorker cartoonist, I wasn't about to let all that rejection get in the way. I would just tell myself every week, you're good. You're as good as the cartoons that are in there. Someday somebody's going to figure that out. And I just kept submitting. I'd take a month or two off every now and then, but I always got back to it. And I can tell you that the day I got the fax from the new cartoon editor who replaced the old cartoon editor who had been rejecting me for all those years, the day I got the fax that I'd sold my first cartoon was perhaps the happiest day of my life.
And that new editor was Bob Mankoff.
Bob, yes.
So was there a kind of cartoon that you submitted to The New Yorker for the 25 years that you were trying to get in?
No, I never, you know, a big mistake a lot of people make, I think, is that they try to do, quote, New Yorker cartoons. I just continued to do David Cypress cartoons. I thought what I thought was funny was funny, and I just kept doing it. And I just needed them to adjust. You know, I need them to expand their idea of what a funny cartoon is, what a good cartoon is. I sound very relaxed and adult about it now. The honest truth is, a lot of that time I felt pretty. I have a cartoon in the book where these two sort of guys are sitting on the street. They're obviously homeless and destitute, and one saying to the other, "Okay, maybe failure is an option."
Yeah.
And there was a lot of that thinking that went on that I had to push aside.
How did you keep submitting? Was it through the mail? Did you knock on doors? How did that work?
I lived in Boston for a lot of that time, and that was by the mail. But I started coming in person on the look day, which is Tuesday, once I moved to New York in 83. But that had its own sort of frisson of humiliation, because the people who were already in the magazine got to go into the inner sanctum and meet with the editor, and those of us who weren't had to just hand our batch to the receptionist. And then you'd come back on Friday morning, and you'd get your batch, and you'd stand by the elevator and say a little prayer, and you open it up, and there was your rejection slip. So, but I did do it in person from about 83 to 97 when I sold my first one.
Your father kept telling you to give up on the idea of being a professional cartoonist and go back to pursuing a career as a historian. You studied Russian history at Harvard before you dropped out to pursue a career as a cartoonist. Did that get to you? Did that ever get to you, his very discouraging words about your dream?
I think I never really got over the desire to have him approve my choices. It was really hard at the start. There is a chapter in my book about my response to his finding out that I had dropped out of school and the anger that he expressed over the phone and how that nearly destroyed me, really. And I hadn't even realized to that moment how much his approval and support had meant to me, and to not have it anymore was pretty upsetting. And even, you know, to the end, I tell in the book that when I did finally sell a cartoon to The New Yorker, and even my father would see that a cartoon in The New Yorker was some kind of success. Maybe not as big a success as being, the ambassador of the United Nations or a hotshot lawyer, but he recognized that as some kind of success. And when I sold that first cartoon, the first person I called after my wife was my father. And then what I didn't know was that when you sell a cartoon to The New Yorker, it doesn't mean it's going to appear that week or the next week. In fact, I sold that cartoon in October, and it didn't appear until July. And sadly, in the interim, my father died and never got to see it. And every week until he died, he would call me and say, "David, I got my New Yorker. You're not in there." And said, "Are you?" Then he started saying, "Are you sure you sold that cartoon? You weren't just dreaming that." So the great disappointment was he never got to see it.
When he looked into the future, your father always saw a negative outcome. So always like a worst case scenario that he predicted. Are there examples that you remember?
Yeah, I mean, I finally figured out that what he was doing was he was sort of giving himself a preemptive shot of disappointment and pain so that when the bad thing happened, he'd at least be prepared. And he did that about everything. You know, if he was going to the doctor, he'd hear him say things like, "This pain in my back has got to be back cancer." He just always expected the worst. And there are a million examples, but including about me, that these choices I was making were going to wind up ruining my life. So there was always this, what I called negative chicken counting, from that expression, "Don't count your chickens." You usually say that to people about, you know, don't count your chickens about good things that are going to happen. Well, my father was always counting his chickens about bad things that were going to happen.
And he probably wasn't aware of that. It strikes me, your father doesn't sound like a very introspective man. He didn't speak the language of psychology. You have been in therapy for many years and really appreciate the help that it's given you in understanding your life and the stories that you tell yourself about your life and about your family. And I'm wondering if that was a source of frustration for you to see things that he was doing, to see his like negative chicken counting, knowing that he didn't see that and that he wouldn't see that.
I understood that almost from the time I was a small boy. I understand that what I say at one point is my father always looked out, never in. Someone was saying to me recently that people of that generation who had real problems and real difficulties when they were young, I mean real world ones, didn't really have time to develop that sort of inner life that those of us can indulge ourselves in these days. But it all through my life, I didn't have that perspective. I just kept being frustrated that I couldn't have a conversation with him about how he was feeling about something. I couldn't have a conversation with him about the ways I felt he was getting in his own way, because he just never, as you said, he just never looked at the world that way. And, you know, I've been in therapy for much of my life, and my father never, as I say in the book, spent a millisecond, quote, working on his issues.
Yeah. Your father's attitude was no one ever said you were supposed to be happy. Like when you told him you were dropping out of Harvard, where you were studying Russian history, so that you could pursue a career as a cartoonist, he said to you, what, because you're unhappy? You're unhappy? That's it? That's it? And you quote him as saying, listen, mister, who's happy? Nobody. That's who. You think life is a bed of roses? After all we've done for you, this is how you repay us? That sounds so familiar. Yeah. I think so many parents, and maybe especially Jewish parents of that generation or immigrant parents of that generation, I don't know, but I think you have a lot of company. And having parents who would say that, where do you think that comes from?
I think it comes from the difficult story that my father was so reticent to tell me about, of where he came from and how he got to be where he is. And the whole time, being a Jew and being an immigrant, there just is a natural pessimism that comes with that. And happiness, who has time for happiness? When my father said that to me, I even said at that moment that telling him that my desire was to be happy, even that sounded pathetically insufficient to me because I had been so ingrained with his point of view. And I'm not 100% sure where that comes from, but I think it has something to do with the difficulty of becoming the totally assimilated American business success that he was, and how hard that was, and how much work there was involved in that, and also wanting me to do something that he could be proud of. And as far as he was concerned, those are the kinds of choices that involve hard work and suffering. Cartooning to him just looked like I was just fooling around.
He probably also thought he was protecting you from inevitable failure.
His attitude about happiness really never entirely left my subconscious. And it's funny because I actually still may have a little bit of residual guilt about this career choice that I made, that it's too much fun, that I'm having too good a time, that I should be suffering more. What I tell is that I don't work at home. I always have a separate space that I go to do my work, which a lot of cartoonists do, and I think that explains a lot of the desert island cartoons, because I need a separate place that's completely quiet and my own. And it's also a way of fooling myself into thinking I have a regular job, you know, that I'm going to the office every day instead of just sitting, getting out of bed and starting to work at home. And I think that has to do with the guilt I've always felt about choosing such a fun profession that maybe it's not serious enough. So I still, to a certain extent, carry around my father's notions of happiness. The thing that I've realized towards the end of the book, ironically, was the only time I ever saw my father really happy was when he was working. The only time I saw him not suffering was when he was in his store, dealing with his customers and being proud of everything he'd accomplished. And so, in spite of the fact that he told me that real work involves suffering, at some point I realized, well, he wasn't suffering at all at work. So,
you know, we've talked a lot about you. We've talked a lot about your father. Let's talk about me for a moment. You did a cartoon about me a few years ago, and it was just like such a thrill. So would you describe the cartoon?
Yeah, it's a cocktail party, and I draw you from behind because I always think it's funnier to portray people without caricaturing their faces. So I tried to imagine what you would look like from behind, having never met you, and people tell me I did a pretty good job. And you're at a cocktail party and you're talking to this sort of well-dressed couple and you say to them, "You may have heard me on Fresh Air with Terry Gross. I'm Terry Gross." And in preparation for talking to you today, I felt you might ask me about this, and I was trying to think, well, what's funny about that cartoon? And my wife suggested that it says something about the way people behave at cocktail parties, or maybe the fact that you are a disembodied voice and you are trying to posit that you're actually a real person. But for me, it's one of those cartoons I've done where I really can't say what's funny about it. And that's why I love those cartoons. It's just a sort of a mystery. It's just something about it that's funny that I can't put my finger on. And that's why it's one of the ones I really love.
Does it have something to do with somebody's name being part of a title of a show?
Absolutely. But first of all, one thing you learn writing captions is that every single word, every punctuation mark, everything in that caption matters. You want the reader to glide smoothly through the caption to the punchline without anything distracting them. And you want to make everything in it as funny as possible. And Terry, you have a funny name.
I do.
It really helps. Gross is a funny name.
Yeah, that's true.
It wouldn't have worked as well with, I don't know, somebody else. But Gross is just funny in and of itself.
So I just have to tell you something about the factness of that cartoon. So I am depicted in your cartoon wearing what looks from behind like a skirted suit, and wearing a skirt that, you know, comes like considerably below my knee. I want you to know I haven't worn a skirt or a dress in decades. And I want to know, where were those New Yorker fact checkers when you put me in a skirt?
Good point. Good point, Terry. Good point. Can I tell you the funniest story about the fact checkers that there is?
Yes, please.
Years ago, I did a cartoon of, it's sort of an ancient scene with an ancient building in the background, and it's a guy with a sword leading a goat, and the goat is turning to another goat and saying, "I'm having my entrails read," really excited. Well, I got a note from the fact-checking department that said the knife was incorrectly drawn. It should be a single-bladed knife, blah, blah, blah. They even sent me a picture. And that on the building, there were five columns, and there were always only even-numbered columns, so they asked me to change the number of columns. So I wrote back to the fact-checking department, and I said, "I understand your problem with the knife. I understand your problem with the number of columns. Why didn't you have a problem with the fact that there's a talking goat?"
What was the response?
A big laugh from the assistant cartoon editor, but nothing from the fact checker.
So, you know, you had a very troubled relationship with your father. When you went through his possessions after he died, one of the things that you found that really made you tear up in a way that you hadn't before was a sketch that he did of a dog. And I have to say, his lines are so graceful in it. And you didn't know he was doing that.
Well, I knew that he could draw really well, because He kept an inventory of everything that ever went in and out of his store. And at that time, he never would have thought of photography. He drew every single bracelet, every single pair of cufflinks, every single piece of silver. He drew them on index cards and then wrote what they were. And so he was very skilled with a pencil. I had never seen him draw anything but jewelry, etc. And when I was going through the file cabinet and I pulled out that card, I suddenly had a picture of him sort of stopping in his drawing of whatever bracelet or necklace he was drawing and looking up and seeing a dog on the street and drawing the dog. And that just, for whatever reason, I can't quite explain it. It moved me more than anything else. Maybe it just let me know that he, deep down, he was an artist like me.
David Cypress, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Terry.
David Cypress is a New Yorker cartoonist. His new memoir is called What's So Funny? Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Jenny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brugger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Our digital media producer is Molly C.V. Nesper. I'm Terry Gross.